Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Above Politics Show. I'm Martin Bain.
And I'm Homer Fine.
And it gets easier the second week back.
And it's good, because it's good we have you back, Martin. I was lost without you, trust me.
That's so nice. And I suppose we can talk about things that are lost, that the governor of Illinois might be losing his freedom.
Yeah, what a moron.
It's interesting. See, I didn't know that when someone, you know, becomes president or, you know, secretary of state, because this is obviously going to affect Hillary Clinton, that you just didn't have another election for the Senate seat. Because in the United Kingdom, if an MP resigns or dies, we have what we call as a by-election, which is a small election for the constituency. Would be, for example, the area that would be covered by a Senate seat, and we just have a mini election. So everyone does the election things. People go around, they put rubbish through your letterbox, they'll put rubbish in your papers, and there might be some local TV adverts, and then on a particular day people will go out and vote in that constituency. And that's what I thought you did in the state.
Well, after this debacle in Illinois, it's quite possible that we will start doing that. But no, here in the states, as a general rule, the governor, the elected governor of the state, will appoint someone to fill out the rest of the term, particularly if it's under 2 years. But in this instance, apparently, Mr. Blagojevich, I believe is how his name is pronounced, has Blagojevich. That was at Blagojevich. Democrat, by the way, I'd like to point that out, has decided that this is a golden opportunity for him to apparently make some money. Now, Martin, I'm not sure if you're familiar at all, but Illinois in particular, Chicago, is a hotbed of corruption and has been in the United States since the 50s, and actually before the 50s, during the years of Prohibition, when gangsters came into play, and this was the center for the mafia, the mob, and localized crime syndicates. So this is really nothing new for Illinois. It just seems like it had faded off the radar with all of the modern policing and the crackdown on characters like this. But he's fitting right in.
But it's shocking that this is at the top of, you know, your Illinois state administration. I mean, if it's true, and I've heard a little bit about some of the things that he's alleged to have said. And what I did find amusing was he was saying, I don't care, record me, tape me, I don't mind. And clearly, if you have a look at some of the recordings that the FBI have, they've obviously been recording him for several weeks. But, you know, the fact that he sort of saw this as an opportunity, almost like a pension fund, you know, an opportunity to make some money, which I'm sure it must actually go on, but to be so blatant about it does seem very odd.
Well, I think it's just as odd. President-elect Obama's statement was that this is a sad day for Illinois, and then he says, beyond that, I don't think it's appropriate to comment. What does he mean it's not appropriate to comment? Of course it's appropriate to comment.
It's his constituency that are being affected by this, and he's also the man who allegedly wants to be, you know, who's going to be the next president of the United States. So I think you're right. Maybe, again, we've spoken about this, he's obviously got some fairly clever people in his back office. Maybe they've said, this one isn't going to look good for anybody. Try and distance yourself from this as much as possible. Because obviously there must have been a fairly close relationship between the governor of Illinois and Barack Obama. And there was even some reports were saying that the governor was maybe looking to be part of the team in Washington. But I suspect now, if he was on Barack Obama's list for some job, he's probably off the list now.
But what's going to happen Martin, is this going to continue to be the statements that are coming out of the Obama administration? Is it constantly going to be removing himself or distancing himself? Is this going to be what we can expect from the Obama administration in everything that might come back to bite him? Is he going to avoid every bit of controversy? And yes, this is controversial, but like you say, this is his constituency. This is something that he should be concerned with, and yet he's just stepping back from it, like you say, just protecting himself at all costs.
And maybe in the short term, that's what he's got to do. I mean, you're right. I mean, I know everyone's going to be saying, you know, you can't judge what the man's going to do now because he's, you know, not got the reins of power. And I suspect, you know, we will probably be analyzing Barack Obama's, you know, first day in office, his first week in office. I mean, I think people normally say, you know, what's his 90 or 100 day plan? Because ultimately, you know, he's coming in at a time of, you know, economic difficulty, not only in the US but across the world. And, you know, he's also got, you know, he's probably two biggest things on his plate when he opens the door to the Oval Office will be the American economy, the global economy, and what to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's probably all you actually want him to do in some respect.
And speaking of Iraq, it would appear that your troops are taking a hiatus from Iraq in March, I believe it is.
Well, yeah, I've read about this one. And, you know, the argument there would be, well, do we need to have so many active combat troops actually in territory? You know, as the Iraqi forces come up to speed, do they need as much? And I have to think that This is a get out that I'm sure the American administration would actually like to try and engineer as well. And I suspect, you know, Barack Obama has clearly made statements to say, you know, he thinks Afghanistan is the place to be. I suspect that, yes, we will probably reduce our presence in Iraq. I suspect some of those troops may well go to Afghanistan, where I think that's probably a campaign that has a better press. And, you know, I think people across the world probably think that that's not as horrendous as potentially what happened in Iraq. Yeah,
well, I mean, Martin, I want your opinion on this, and I'm going to give you a little bit of facts before I give you the question. There are 135,000 United States military troops currently stationed in South Korea, and they are there at the behest and request of the South Korean government. And to the best of my knowledge, there is not, nor has there ever been, any plans to remove these troops from South Korea, simply because they are one of our allies. There are currently, if I'm not mistaken, something over 150,000 troops in Iraq. Now, these are United States troops, but I want your opinion on the British forces that are pulling out, because there are British forces in South Korea as well. Now, we are there at the behest and the request of the legally elected government of Iraq. They have requested that we maintain a presence in Iraq. Why is Iraq an issue and South Korea isn't, other than the fact that people are getting killed in Iraq, and no one is getting killed? We're not basically in a combat situation. The war's over. We are simply there to stabilize the government that has been elected to run the country of Iraq. So why is this such a different situation to people?
I suppose I'd go back and say Korea was a peninsula of Korea was sort of separated fundamentally after the Korean War. Probably, you know, we didn't actually get, you know, there were people in South Korea who actually wanted the United Nations forces at the time. And I suppose one of the things we have to consider is that, you know, South Korea isn't just a US issue, it's a United Nations thing. So I suppose it's slightly different. Whereas to my mind, Iraq, I don't see Iraq as being a United Nations issue. And if, because clearly you have to look at so many people in the United Nations were against any campaign in Iraq in the first place. So that's what I see as the difference is politically, I think Iraq is seen as a Anglo-US with some of our allies issue, whereas Korea came out of an invasion from North Korea that the United Nations, and I think that's probably the real key here, the United Nations did that. And you know, some people still believe that the actions by the US and UK militaries was an invasion of a country that did not want it, because at the time Saddam Hussein did not ask for any help from the American or British governments. So I suppose it's probably history here that sort of does this.
So basically what you're saying, it's a politically correct issue. It's politically correct to be in South Korea. It's just not politically correct to be in Iraq. And see, that's the problem I have.
Yeah. But then you have to think that, you know, we did invade a sovereign country when we went into Iraq. And if you take that analogy, why haven't we invaded North Korea? Why haven't we invaded China? Why haven't we sorted out problems in Somalia, in Zimbabwe, and a whole host of countries? You know, let's be brutally, the only reason that Iraq was so interesting to the Americans and the British was because it had oil. And you know, anyone who tries to pretend that, you know, we were being good and getting rid of some nasty dictator, I think that's very naive, because you only have to look around other parts of the world and there are some equally nasty and despotic people. You know, why haven't we been into Burma and things like that? So it was purely because we needed to protect oil.
And I can't argue that point, but still, it's like crying over spilled milk. We have invaded. We have deposed Saddam. He's gone. So now we are there. The Iraqi parliament just met and just voted to request that we maintain our presence there. So we have been officially asked by an official government to maintain a presence. So I think that we're still mixing apples and oranges here. I think it's exactly the same as South Korea. I understand what you're saying, and I too have problems with the reason that we went into Iraq. But let's face it, we did. Your country, my country, and several other countries went to Iraq. We deposed Saddam Hussein, who arguably was not the most vile leader in charge of a country, not by a long shot, but we did. We've already done that. And there is a quasi-democratically elected government in Iraq who are now requesting that we stay there. Why is that request less than the same request that we get, I think it's every 4 years it comes up for, that we're in South Korea? So I don't understand. I understand the difference. I just think it's very hypocritical.
Absolutely. It probably is very hypocritical. And I suppose one of the things that some people might turn around and say here is, well, but, you know, is the government and the leadership of Iraq strong enough to resist any pressure from the US administration? Whereas you look at South Korea and you say, you know, it's a country that's fundamentally strong in its own rights. So, you know, I just think that's probably a big difference.
I can't disagree with you. And again, Iraq's a hotbed. And you guys are leaving 400 British personnel in the country, according to the news reports here. So you are going to leave a presence. And I don't know how many people you actually have in South Korea. But I think that we can look at the United States particularly is going to have a strong presence in Iraq for the near foreseeable future. I do not see Barack Obama or any other presidential nominee, any other president in the next three elections. I'll stick my head out and say for the next 12 years, we will maintain a strong military presence in Iraq simply because we're there and we've been asked to stay.
And you're absolutely right. I don't disagree with that. I wouldn't be betting against you on this one, but yeah, I suppose we also have to think of how big the British military is compared to the US military. And, you know, we do have a lot of our combat troops in Afghanistan. So I think from our point of view, it's probably more difficult for us to replace or put fresh troops in to combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, potentially within the US, you have what's called as the National Guard. Within the UK, we have what we call as a Territorial Army. And I'm loath to sort of say they're equivalent, but, you know, we have a reserve force that has been fairly well accessed to put troops, to try and put some fresh troops on the ground.
Now, let me ask you something, Martin. Why, all of a sudden, why the increased concern about our presence in Afghanistan?
Because fundamentally, I think Afghanistan is probably a more right word to use here. That's probably something that has a real outcome. Whereas potentially Iraq was fundamentally oil, and then let's get rid of some rather nasty leader. Whereas I think Afghanistan is the home of the Taliban, is the home of people who inspired 9/11, who inspired 7/7, who inspired potentially the attacks on Mumbai in India. And I just think that's probably one that the rest of the world probably doesn't look on as cynically as they do in Iraq. So I just think it is that the rest of the world thinks, actually, if these guys go and clean up Afghanistan and get rid of the Taliban, actually, that might make life easier across the world. You know, that, you know, France has had, you know, potential issues. You know, there was the bombing of trains in Spain that were alleged back to, you know, Muslim fundamentalism. So I think the rest of the world probably looks at Afghanistan and thinks, well, if these guys can clean up Afghanistan and, you know, sort that out, that's actually going to make life in the rest of the world potentially less dangerous. So I think the rest of the world is probably thinking, we're not going to bellyache too much about what's going on in Afghanistan because it's in our own interest.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, Martin, no one has ever been able to clean up Afghanistan. We are not going to clean up Afghanistan. That is a remote, horribly terrain deficient country for any type of mobilization. Just ask the Russians.
Oh, hey, you know, just go back long before the Russians, the British tried it, and yet in the very late 1800s, you know, the very late 1800s, we tried to subdue that part of the world as well. So, you know, we got our asses kicked then. We came to peace agreements. Absolutely, Russia, you know, was the balance to the US for many years. You know, be brutal, they got their asses kicked as well. And I suspect you're right. We will probably make some inroads and we will probably kill some Taliban leaders. But you're absolutely right. We'll never get rid of the Taliban and the ideas that they stand for. So you're absolutely right. You know, and let's be brutally, one of the things that I see about this one is it keeps, shockingly, it means that we have troops that are combat trained and ready.
Yeah, me and you've talked about that before offline. And, you know, as harsh as that sounds, it is a viable concept. We cannot afford to allow ourselves to lapse the way the world governments and the way the world economic situation even is unfolding right here before our very eyes. For us to allow our combat troops to lapse and to lose that amount, and yes, I'm going to use this term, training, would be very remiss on our part, because like we talked about before, China can apparently uniform and move out something like, I forget how big their army is, but it's ridiculous.
It's probably millions.
Yeah, absolutely, but it's millions of conscripted clergy and bookkeepers,
farmers, agricultural laborers.
Right, where we're going to put in a few hundred thousand actual combat experienced troops. So we hold the upper hand when it comes to that. And if we ever lose that, Martin, God help us all.
Absolutely. I mean, I know we'll be speaking off air about this one, and I firmly believe that the British government could have sold or got rid of the IRA leadership in Northern Ireland. I'm of the belief that British intelligence knew who the key players were in Northern Ireland, and I believe they could have asked special forces units or other parts of the, you know, intelligence services. I believe they could have solved that problem or just stunted the leadership of the IRA so hard in a series of coordinated attacks on the leadership. They didn't. They will turn around and say we didn't have proof. But I still have a suspicion that Troubles in Ireland was there as a very good training ground for British troops. You know, and I know some of your background, you know, British troops, you know, the vast majority of the British Army is well respected across the world because we have been involved in, you know, street campaigns, in terrorism. You know, we've done the Falklands War. You know, we have had troops consistently in military campaigns that have kept that edge. And I think that edge is showing across the world. And you look at the number of casualties that were sustained in the initial invasion of Iraq. They were low. Without hesitation, I don't think anybody expected the US and UK forces to actually get as far into Iraq and take the whole country with any losses. Tragic, but I think military planners were expecting significantly larger losses.
Yeah, and just to comment on what you said, Martin, as we've spoken before, I have tremendous respect for the British military. I've trained with your military, and you guys are just absolutely incredible. And speaking just from a bystander, for lack of a better word, here in the United States, you have no idea how many people over here in the United States were looked at that situation that you had with Ireland and thought exactly the same thing. Why doesn't the British military move in there and just clean this up? You're talking one of the most powerful militaries in the world, one of the most powerful standing militaries in the world, and you're having to deal with this crap that you had to deal with in Ireland. And we all knew it was political. We knew it was the politically correct thing to do, but I kind of like your theory there. the fact that it was used as a training ground, for lack of a better term. And it's a shame to say that, but, you know, it makes sense.
And maybe Jim Mars can talk about this. If he ever brings out a sequel to the Above Top Secret book, he could use this as one of the subjects.
Well, he has apparently branched out, because if you look on the AboveTopSecret.com website, one of our top flagged threads was written by Jim Mars, and it is titled Barack Obama is qualified to be president ... isn't he, with a question mark.
Now this is interesting, because I know you and I have both had a quick search about this, and I certainly can't find a lot in the, what they might call as the mainstream media, and I suspect this is all going back to Barack Obama's birth certificate and whether he could actually stand and then be elected as President of the United States. So my thought is here, well, is it just that Above Top Secret is so far ahead of the news? And in a lot of cases, we frequently are. We probably reported and had threads on issues before they make the mainstream post. And then when they get in the mainstream post, you look on ATS, you think, hey, we discussed this weeks ago. Or is it that this really isn't that big an issue?
Well, I will mimic some of the posters on the thread. If, Martin, and let me ask you this, if you were in this situation and people were saying that you couldn't do what it is that you do for a living because your birth certificate wasn't valid, wouldn't the simple thing to do would be to simply produce your birth certificate, something that we all have, hold it up, show everyone, and say, okay, now shut up.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. So, yeah, and unfortunately, we live in such a suspicious time these days that, you know, we now start thinking, well, why hasn't he done that? And then you start thinking, well, if he hasn't done that, there's obviously a reason why he hasn't done that. And you think, okay. But you'd like to think that the Democratic Party might have sorted this out before they, you know, went through the whole process of making him stand for, you know, President of the United States. You'd like to think there's a checklist that says, right, okay, candidate, yes. Anything major criminal in his past, okay, nothing to worry about. Yeah, family seems okay. He's an American citizen. Barrett, I'll come back to you on that one, chaps. Okay, let's go down to the next one. I cannot believe that someone went waiting response from Barack Obama on that one. You're right. I don't know why he won't just go out and do that, because you were saying that people tried to get copies of his birth certificate from Hawaii, but they'd been sealed for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing just stinks. And the people that are coming on to defend Obama are the same people that will jump at a conspiracy involving the police or any other hotbed issue. But yet they'll come on the Obama thread and go, well, he's not showing his birth certificate because he doesn't have to. Well, that's just ridiculous. And no one's saying that he has to. What we're saying is the common sense is he would do it just in order to quell the rumors, in order to stop the I don't know how many current suits are there going forward trying to force him to show this thing. I think the last I heard there were four.
But ultimately, presumably, any citizen in the United States can turn around and say, hang on a minute, I want to make sure that the person who's been elected to be President of the United States meets all the criteria for that job, and that criteria is enshrined in your Constitution.
Oh, yeah, and of course, then you get into the realm of just ridiculous, because, and let's face it, Martin, I'm not a huge Obama fan, but he is the president now, and he deserves our respect. However, some of the comments that we're getting in defense of this is, well, he has a right to privacy. No, he doesn't. When it comes to his birth certificate, when it comes to him fulfilling the qualifications for the job that he has been elected to, he has zero right to privacy. And we, the American people, have 100% right to make sure that the person that we elected has the qualifications to simply fill the position.
I couldn't agree with you more on this one. I think you're absolutely right. You know, if you want to stand for President of the United States, for Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, for Prime Minister of Canada, Australia, and no doubt a whole, you know, Prime Minister and President of Russia, you know, as far as I'm concerned, to a degree, you forego privacy. You know, you are saying that I am going to be in the public domain, in the public spotlight. Anything that, you know, even celebrities do, even, you know, and yet it's down to that level, anything they do, you know, if they come out and they're dressed wrongly, you know, people are criticizing them. You're right. And I don't know why Barack Obama's team and the Democrats don't just come out and say, hey, here's his birth certificate. Now can we move on to something more interesting?
Yeah, and it's the hypocrisy. And I hate to keep using that word. It seems like I'm stuck on that word today, Martin. But it's the hypocrisy of the same people who vetted Sarah Palin's daughter and her pregnancy. And they vetted her just to the point of being ridiculous, to the point of where the actual two candidates come out and said, leave the families alone. And yet we can't ask about a president-elect's birth certificate.
But then, Homer, does that then beg the question that did the Democrats, obviously, you know, and you know, I still always wonder what the decision process was in the Republican Party about, you know, John McCain and Sarah Palin. I'd love for somebody to come on air maybe and tell us the logic behind that decision, because I'd love to know what it was. But maybe they realized, you know, the Republicans were thinking, okay, right, it's going to be Sarah Palin. Okay, we need to do some investigation and we need to check in huge detail what goes on in her life. You're absolutely right. It is absolute hypocrisy. And people will no doubt, you know, if they want to comment on what you and I have said, they know where to go. They need to find the show thread and post away.
I still say, and the election of Barack Hussein Obama was given. It was a given. I think the Republican Party elected him just as much as the Democratic Party did. I think that the meteoric rise of McCain above, and I'll say this quite frankly, more qualified, more prepared, and more presidential-like candidates. And all of a sudden, overnight, this man shoots above them, becomes the primary candidate for the Republican Party. Then you add to that that he picks the relative unknown from Alaska, who did give him, it gave his campaign a shot in the arm initially, and that's what everybody thought. Everybody fell in love with Sarah Palin. Then all of a sudden, the hypocrisy, using the word again, rears its ugly head because Sarah Palin says something about being able to see Russia from her home state, and that's all over the news. And yet the fact that Barack Obama believes we have 57 states gets hushed. So I think this whole thing, in my opinion, this entire election was a setup. But that again begs the question, with all of the vetting that goes on, it is just astronomically difficult to believe that the Democratic Party didn't say, okay, Barack, you want to run for president, show me your birth certificate.
Absolutely. And you know, we're just going to have to wait on that. We're going to see whether ATS is so far ahead of other news, or whether it's just that this just doesn't seem to be a non-issue. And if we want to believe all the conspiracy theories here that, you know, this is something that the world government is doing, and, you know, no doubt they'll be trying to come down on ATS to hush us up because we're revealing stuff that they don't want to know about.
Bring it on, Martin. I'm ready for them. Bring they can't it on. Hush me up.
And the other thing I think is just touching on sort of what's going on in US politics is the talk that Bill may be looking to have Hillary's seat when she, you know, hopefully gets nominated as Secretary of State, which I think, now that's an interesting thing, and I think you and I spoke about it last week.
I have only one thing to say, Martin. He's back.
I think, yes. Because presumably it must be the governor of New York State that makes that decision.
Oh, yeah. And I think Mario Cuomo's name is being bandied around as being the top choice. However, you have to kind of look at history. And if he does appoint former President Bill Clinton, he'll be the third. I mean, there are two presidents prior to Mr. Clinton who have gone from the White House back into some sort of a Senate position. But I kind of like some of the names. There's some really qualified people there. Like I said, the first choice, according to Patterson here, is Andrew Cuomo, who is the current New York State Attorney General. But he's also looking at Caroline Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr. I mean, there's some good, strong political names to choose from there. But I can't help but think that the appointment of President Bill Clinton would be a just absolute political grandstand event.
It would be fun, though.
Yeah, it really would. And it's for 2 years. How much harm can he do? And again, like you say, it would really pick politics up out of the gutter where it's been the last few weeks and make it fun again.
And then, you know, if, for example, you know, Barack Obama chooses to only do one term, you could have, you know, Clinton and Clinton running for president and vice president.
Now, wouldn't that be something to talk about around the water cooler?
Yeah, you know, you could think, okay, you've okay, you've done the thing. You've moved from electing white middle-class men to president. You voted a black man to be president. What better than, say, to have a woman as president and then her husband as vice president? You could then turn around and say, actually, hang on a minute. I now think in the space of eight years, the U.S. people and the U.S. political machine has basically knocked almost all barriers away. The only thing you want after that one is then, a declared gay man and a declared lesbian woman as president and vice president, and then I think it's probably done. No one can look at the U.S. and say, it's not exactly a fair and representative country.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what else. There'll be two different views to this, and like I said, this would just be a hoot if anything like this was to ever happen, but there'll be two different views on this, and of course the view from my party, the Republican Party, would be the fact that the political machine in the United States is finally ground to a halt. But like you said, the view from the world view toward us would be, wow, these people have really stepped out of the dark ages and are putting whom they consider to be the best people in the best positions. Because let's face it, if Patterson is going to pick the most experienced political person that he has, how could he possibly not pick Bill Clinton?
Exactly, the man whose Rolodex is probably, bulging, who can probably pick up the phone and talk to most of the political leaders in the world today and can probably pick up the phone and get through to any CEO of any company anywhere in the world just because his secretary says it's Bill Clinton, the former president of the United States. And I suspect, we spoke about this, I think that's an advantage that Hillary Clinton's going to have as well, that not only will she be able to cash in on her reputation, but I think the fact of her husband's reputation will also help. And I am looking forward to a time, when the view of the U.S. or U.S. U.S. political machine across the world, I think, with Barack Obama as president and Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, I suspect that a lot of countries that are probably either neutral or negative towards the U.S., I suspect that's probably going to change. I can only see that as being a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Sean Hannity is 100% incorrect because Obama's selection of Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State was one of the best moves that I've heard in politics in a long time.
Yes. Oh, but then we're still going to have to go. Love to know what was said at the Democratic nominating convention. There were some people. Whether Hillary and Barack were face to face, or whether there were people scurrying between their respective suites, I don't know. And the other question always interested me: just how much of an influence did Bill Clinton maybe have in some of this as well? Because it's obvious that man is a sharp political operator. You have to be thinking, he's maybe thinking, okay, maybe my wife can't do it in 2008, but hang on, 2012, maybe. I think 2016 is probably out, because I suspect people will then go back to the age thing. Because one of the other things is that, the US have now sort of turned around and said, well, we actually want someone, significantly younger to be president. So I now think that you're probably going to get candidates who are going to be of a similar age to Barack Obama now. And I think going back to someone who's 65, 70 is probably, people are going to be thinking, do we really want that?
Well, but that's going to hinge almost completely on what happens with Barack Obama. If he goes in and just makes a complete shambles of the country, if he does a horrible job, then I think the American people are going to turn around and say, okay, we need to pick someone that is a little bit more seasoned, someone who has a few more years under their belt, who's not quite as much a maverick. But getting back to Bill Clinton, there's a couple of ways to look at it, Martin. During the election process, the long drawn-out election process, I saw Bill Clinton being treated by his party almost as a troublemaker. Instead of being an assist, he seemed like they wanted him just to be quiet and stay out of it. And I don't know. I don't know how this could play out, but it's definitely interesting.
It certainly is. Well, it's coming up on time for a quick break, so we'll take a quick break, and then we'll have some articles from some of our international correspondents across the world.
It's the same dream night after night. I hear this beating, this rhythm. I'm wandering like an unfulfilled lost soul through this misty haze. But I keep following the sound. It seems like I walk forever. In the distance I see something beautiful, magnificent. It seems so far away, yet so near that I could reach out and touch it. As I approach closer, I can see millions of people, all ages, races, religions, philosophies. People from around the world and from every nation on terrestrial Earth. They're moving in mass towards something mystical, magical, magnetic. As I follow them, all of a sudden they begin to create a path for me to walk through. I can see something massive on the horizon. As I get closer, I see a banner unfurling in the gentle wind. It says, "Welcome to the revolution." The crowd begins cheering and celebrating. I'm so overwhelmed by the experience that I wake, still hearing the beating of the heart. And then my dream becomes crystal clear. I have found my holy grail. My thirst is quenched. My lifelong quest finally achieved. I have found AboveTopSecret.com. And my beating heart joins theirs. I have become a member. Welcome to our revolution. AboveTopSecret.com.
Hey everyone, this is Homer Fife. My partner Martin Bain and I are the hosts of the Above Politics show on AboveTopSecret.com. Along with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous with the ATS Mix, and Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock with the BTS Mix, we have made it extremely easy to subscribe to all of our shows. Each show thread now has two shortcuts where, if you click them, they will take you to an area where you can either download the shows with iTunes or with our RSS feed. Remember, it's your subscription that helps bring our intelligent community to the entire world. So come on, join all of us. Deny ignorance with the ATS Mix Show with Johnny Anonymous and Dave Rabbit. You can deny boredom with the BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock. And of course, deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and, you guessed it, me, Homer Fife. Come on, be part of the revolution. The Above Network, LLC.
Hi folks, this is Neff with the UK Roundup. The global credit crunch continues to affect the UK, and Conservative leader David Cameron has been on the offensive for most of this week in a series of systematic attacks on Labour's fiscal policies on both TV and radio, with the most recent of the attacks coming during Prime Minister's question time in Parliament. Cameron has alleged that the current Labour policies risk bankrupting the country and may also ruin the pound as a leading world currency. He has repeatedly called for a general election to be held in order to prevent what he describes as a fundamentally bad decision by the government to increase public borrowing by £20 billion. Labour has responded by saying that there was consensus for increased borrowing to stimulate the economy, and has tried to undermine the election calls by saying that in extraordinary times people expect government to govern and not fight a general election. Cameron's attacks on the government come as figures have been released showing manufacturing output dropping by 5% and house sales dropping to 1978 levels, with house prices dropping by about 2.5% and new car sales dropping by the extremely large figure of 36% compared to last year's figures. However, recent polls suggest that 40% of the public trust the current government's financial policies, with only 31% supporting the Conservative views, and it appears that margin of trust is growing, so Cameron may be on shaky ground. In related news, the Bank of England instigated another 1% interest rate cut over the past week, on top of the recent 1.5% reduction, taking the base rate of interest down to 2%, the lowest level since 1951. Major lenders have been slow in passing this cut on to borrowers, and the government has been forced, once again, to intervene and attempt to force the issue. Further rate cuts are unlikely at the present time, but may be instigated in future months should the effects of the various bailout plans currently in effect be less than expected. In other news, the government has revealed its long-awaited review of the UK benefits system, known as the Greg Review, with proposals to force long-term unemployed people back to work by reducing the amount that they are able to claim in benefits from the government should they be deemed not to be trying to find a job or retraining to gain new skills. While some aspects of the review seem to be based on common sense, other aspects may force a significant revolt within the Labour Party when the review gets bill status and is introduced into the Commons for voting into law early next year. The problems arise with encouraging parents of children of less than 1 year old to return to work and forcing single and home educating mothers to seek work without necessarily guaranteeing adequate childcare provision. Problems also arise for carers of disabled people and those with fluctuating illnesses such as Parkinson's disease and ME. The review also does not seem to cater for areas where there are simply not enough jobs to go around. I expect the review to be tweaked slightly before it reaches bill status, as I do not think that the Labour Party would wish to embarrass itself with a significant internal revolt on such an important issue, potentially in an election year. Finally, and on a lighter side, Gordon Brown seems to have landed himself in the mire this week when, during a grilling on the current fiscal policy in Parliament, he proclaimed that his government had saved the world, bringing about uproar and hilarity in the Commons and virtually guaranteeing his place on TV clip shows for years to come. What he apparently meant to say was that his government, working with others, has been instrumental in trying to save the world's economy. Yes, Gordon, we believe that's what you meant. Honestly. But that's all from me this year, so I wish all the listeners a very Merry Christmas and a happy start to the new year, and I hope to be back again in 2009. Back to the guys in the studio.
As Christmas approaches, the national government has been busy with its legislative program, but first things first. At the start of the week, there were calls by so-called defence experts for changes to be made to the New Zealand Defence Force. The call for changes can be summed up as turning the army into a smaller force that is attached to the navy, modelled along the lines of the US Marine Corps. The suggestion is half right because New Zealand is a maritime nation. Clearly the navy and air force play a vital role in the country's national security. Reducing the size of the army and focusing on clipping the smaller force sounds like the disaster, or rather the disastrous, Rumsfeld Doctrine. Defence Minister Wayne Mapp was right when he said, "It's much better that our specialist capabilities that we use overseas, our provincial reconstruction team, the SAS, the Orions, that they can do their job properly, that we give them the tools to do the job properly." Nowhere was it mentioned that it isn't enough for New Zealand to contribute a provincial reconstruction team in Afghanistan. We also have to take our share of the combat load as well until the enemy is defeated. The usual demand for personnel that professional militaries suffer from was also mentioned. Moving on, National is fulfilling its election promise, or rather bribe, to extend the taxpayer-funded per perception, apologies for the pronunciation, treatment for breast cancer sufferers from 9 weeks to a year. Since PharmAct, the government agency that purchases medications, previously advised to refuse to do this, the current government circumvented the process by having the health, by having the Ministry of Health fund the extension and treatment. And don't get me wrong, there was a demand for this from some quarters, and I feel for those who are suffering from breast cancer, but the cynic in me does say that this is more about the National Party appealing to women voters who don't traditionally vote blue than anything else. The National Party did something of a variation on its KiwiSaver policy. KiwiSaver is the name of the New Zealand superannuation scheme that was brought in by the previous government. Under National's plan to reduce the compulsory employer contributions from 4% to 2%, people earning less than $52,000 a year wouldn't have reached the $1,040 threshold, which is where the government contributions kick in. So to get around this, National will match dollar-for-dollar contributions up to $1,040. After that, the 2% employer contribution and presumably the government contribution of up to $20 kicks in. National would have dearly loved to have scrapped the scheme, but since KiwiSaver proved to be more popular than anybody had expected, the best National could get away with, if they wanted to win government, was to reduce employer contributions. Time does not permit me to go into greater detail concerning KiwiSaver. The contentious 90-day bill, which allows small businesses to take on new employees for a 90-day trial period and fire them without facing an unfair dismissal suit, looks set to be passed into law, although anti-discrimination and sexual harassment laws still apply. Under the law, small business is defined as having 20 employees or less. The law will apply to the majority of employers. The bill will pass into law without the support of the Māori Party, who is unhappy with the risk to workers' rights and the speed which the legislation will pass into law. The legislation will pass due to the support of the ACT Party. Both the changes to employment law and KiwiSaver are being hurried into law before Christmas because they are more of National's unpopular policies and they are hoping that people won't notice due to the time of year. I have now outlined the major points for the week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back, and I want to take just a second to thank all the people that contribute to the show, and also put out to people out there, we are still looking for and would love to have contributions from members from other countries. Nothing wrong with Great Britain, nothing wrong with the United States, nothing wrong with Canada, but if you are in another country and you have a political viewpoint, which I'd like to think that you do, if you'll contact either myself or Martin via U2U, we will walk you through the process and we will put you on the air and you can listen to us. So what else you got up your sleeve, Martin?
Well, one of the interesting things was the recent terrorist attacks in Mumbai, which is in India, which is sort of probably one of the economic powerhouse cities of the Indian economy. And some fundamental terrorists took over some hotels and were going around shooting Westerners. And what interested me about this one was not that the terrorist incident happened, which is absolutely horrendous. And we've got a feel for the families, not only of Westerners, but of the police and people in India who have also died as a result of this one. But one of the things I saw, that India was so up in arms about this one, press reports that some of the militants involved in this campaign started their journeys in Pakistan, and I heard a radio article that Pakistan had had to maybe cash some favours with the US and UK administrations to have a word with India to stop them from invading, which I think was particularly interesting because India and Pakistan aren't exactly the best of friends. And a little bit of history here, that when British rule left India in the late 40s, India was partitioned it was basically split down a more Muslim dominated areas and non-Muslim dominated areas, and Pakistan was the country that was formed in the more Muslim areas, and India was probably Sikh and Hindu and some Buddhism. So that's really the history here. So sort of from day one, the British basically split what was then known as India in half, and not in half, but split the country almost down religious lines. So, India and Pakistan have had an interesting time, and there have been numerous conflicts between the two. And Pakistan clearly is a very important country for the US and the UK. It is the front line with Afghanistan. It's been a very key ally in the war on terror. We know very well that the Americans have been able to use Pakistan as bases for operations in that part of the world. But it was just interesting that, Pakistan was so concerned potentially by, rumours and reports that India was looking to, start another war with Pakistan over this one, that they had to go and talk to very senior US and UK leaders, which I think is very interesting.
Well, it begs the question, Martin, what's happening to the world? Just because these terrorists trained and came from Pakistan, in no way, in my opinion, no way implicates the Pakistani government as being complicit. And yet, isn't that the first thing that comes up? And I'm speaking here as a member of AboveTopSecret.com, quite possibly the largest conspiratorial website on the net. And we're always looking at conspiracies, but you have to kind of step back and use some common sense here. The people that were responsible for our 911 came from Saudi Arabia, and we most certainly did not invade Saudi Arabia. I don't know that we did any sanctions against Saudi Arabia, because these terrorists acted independently exactly the same way they did in Pakistan, and yet India is quick to jump in and say, okay, well, it's Pakistan's fault. Well, how is it the government's fault that these idiots decided to go on a shooting spree?
I think, we're coming from a conspiracy website. I'm sorry, I cannot believe that the events of 9/11 were planned and that Saudi Arabian intelligence didn't have some clue what was going on. Bearing in mind, when you think about the sort of culture and nature of some of these countries and the way that people are so intertwined by families and and by the way things are done. So I believe that Saudi Arabian intelligence probably knew that there was something was being planned. I suspect that Pakistani intelligence, the SIS, probably knew what was going on, that there was something being planned that may well have been out there to target India. So I just don't believe that in these countries that their intelligence services, who are, you know, certainly the Pakistani SIS is certainly seen as sort of a fairly aggressive organisation. I'm sure someone there knew what was going on and maybe turned a blind eye. That's my conspiracy theory here. And I suspect the same with the Saudi Arabian intelligence services. I suspect there were people there that knew what was being planned at 9/11 and maybe didn't act or didn't push the report up the line, maybe put it in the bottom of the pile and walked away from it.
But what does all this mean to us, Martin? What it means I'll tell you one thing it means to us. They are both nuclear people. We need to keep an eye on this. Pakistan and India are both nuclear nations. And, okay, I might be doing the George Bush pronunciation, but it is early in the morning here for me. But these two countries do not need to go at it. This is something that the United Nations, the United States, Great Britain, we need to get in there, and we need to negotiate between these two countries before any sort of aggression begins. And I'm being very serious about this. These are not two countries you want to play around with and just let things happen.
Absolutely not. You know, I'd like to think that, you know, because of historical ties potentially back to India, you know, that, you know, we probably can talk to India in a fairly, you know, as sort of, you know, the colonial power that was. And I still think there is a fairly strong bond between India and the United Kingdom. I suspect that bond is less between Pakistan and the United Kingdom. I think the US has probably become, you know, one of its, you know, major confidants across the world. And yes, you're absolutely right. The fact that both have nuclear weapons, you know, I think has to be a concern. You know, but also you have to sort of think on the relative sizes of the country. I mean, you know, India, you know, is a huge, huge country. You know, has a population of in excess of, you know, must be touching a billion people now, you know, and its military probably not, you know, there again we go back to the question, both the Indian and Pakistani militaries have been involved in conflict against each other over the last 40, 50 years. You know, they have elements of their military that are very combat trained, have that combat edge. You know, clearly I think we do have to be keeping an eye on these people. But yeah, I mean, I can see why, you know, India would want to lash out. You know, it's had terrorists. You know, India's not exactly seen as the kind of country that exports terrorism across the world. And potentially it sees a neighbouring country that it believes should probably have done more to stop this from happening. It didn't. So it says, fine, well, go out and sort the problem for them. You can't fault you can't fault that kind of logic when a country is hurt as badly as India has been following these terrorist incidents in Mumbai.
It's a fine line, isn't it? The distinction between a country that could possibly have done more to have prevented something like this, such as Pakistan, and their knowledge that this was going to happen, and a country that actually promotes what happens. I mean, there is a fine line there, and I think that we need to keep an eye on things like that. But there again, I'm not faulting India. I think that the pressure that they're putting on Pakistan to come up with better details on what they knew and how much they knew about these gunmen. But I also worry about that one person who's sitting there with his hand on the trigger and can instigate an international incident between these two nuclear countries. And it just, you know, just worries the heck out of me.
I'm just going to take this hand grenade out, and I'm going to take the pin out, and I'm just going to chuck it. I just think it's fun. But let's be brutal.
Yep.
How much of an impact would it be on the United Kingdom and the United Kingdom if Pakistan and India trade a couple of nuclear weapons?
Whoa. I'm not sure I want to touch that.
And that's why I warned you. You know, I did the classic, you know, like Dave Rabbit says, a sidebar. I said I was going to chuck this one. And hey, I want to see what other people think out there. You know, let's just throw that one around. What's the impact?
Would it stop there?
Sorry?
Would it stop there?
Nah, I suspect yes, because I suspect, let's just take this one down the road a little bit. Pakistan and India trade one or two nuclear weapons each, you know, Karachi's hit, New Delhi's hit, maybe another Indian city, and then, you know, India fires back and hits another Pakistani city. You know, and then all of a sudden the United Nations and the rest of the world go in there and say, look, chappies, let's not be stupid here. I suspect that it wouldn't lead to an all-out nuclear attack from around the world, because ultimately China wouldn't want that to happen. Certainly the US wouldn't want it to happen. The UK wouldn't want it to happen. Russia wouldn't want it to happen. So you're thinking they're the other, you know, major nuclear powers. Yes, South Africa may have it. Israel is going to do potentially what the US is going to say. You know, you can see that, you know, okay, if they do that, you know, sometimes you have to have a little fight somewhere in the world for the rest of everyone to think, whoa. And sometimes after that, you might find that more and more people say, whoa, we have to try and do something to stop this from ever escalating again. But that's my little hand grenade in.
And that's quite a hand grenade.
Hey, if you're going to chuck one, you might as well chuck one that's going to throw muck and rubbish as far as you can reach. So, hey, if you disagree with what I've said, hey, that's because Homer didn't say this. You disagree with what I've said, you know what to do. You can you to you me, you can you to you Homer, if you like, and say, how'd you put up with him? That's different. But you can also go to the show thread and post away. But, you know, we're on a conspiracy website. You know, this is what we do. We have ideas and we put them out there, you know, and, you know, we have some very sharp people on AboveTopSecret.com. You know, if they're rubbish ideas, they're going to get shot down. If they're ideas that people think, that's an idea, it could run and run.
Now, I was just looking at the headlines, Martin, and there's an interesting thing here. Apparently, you or your country has decided to air a suicide documentary.
Yes, this is something that sort of, you know, has come to the fore in the United Kingdom, but I think is interesting across the whole world, is that many people in the UK who are suffering from illnesses, you know, degenerative illnesses, or illnesses that are going to end in potentially a fairly painful death, are taking the option to go potentially to Switzerland to a charity called Digitas, which we're not advertising it, not condoning it or anything, but just trying to give you some facts here. And, you know, and Digitas are helping people who want to commit suicide, because in the United Kingdom it is illegal to I still believe it's actually illegal to commit suicide, and you can actually be prosecuted for trying to commit suicide yourself, and people can also be prosecuted for assisting a suicide in the United Kingdom. And there have been several attempts to try and get this tested in law. Just recently, a couple have helped their 23-year-old son go to Digitas in Switzerland and end his life. He was a rugby player who was paralyzed from the chest down at the age of 23. And you know, I've got to say, you know, I'm sort of thinking, I don't ever want to be placed in that situation. But, you know, you're sort of thinking, 23 years old, you know, up and coming rugby player, into training, and then he is, you know, cannot walk or do anything. So that's really sad. So it's interesting, and I think it brings up a very big subject about whether people. What is people's views on suicide? Is it something that people should be allowed to do? As we all get older, you know, as our populations get older, you know, are there going to be more and more people who are going to don't want to sort of spend 25 years in hospital, you know, in not a good quality of life? I mean, you know, it's something I think that all of us have to think about.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that this is a fairly new phenomenon that has historical roots. I mean, suicide in several cultures all over the world has been an accepted way of terminating your own existence, which, let's face it, Martin, my life is mine. I personally feel, as a Christian, that it's my right. It's my right to end my life if that's what I choose to do. However, there are many of my fellow Christians who believe that suicide is the unforgivable sin, that if you commit suicide, you're going to, I guess, just burn in hell for the rest of your life. But
I mean, we only have to, you know, certainly the Roman Catholic faith, you know, very,
you know, it just flies in the face of common sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, clearly for them, if someone commits suicide, you know, for them, it's the ultimate it's one of the most heinous sins that you can commit from their point of view against God. And you're right, I can see that argument that, you know, if you do take a more religious view of this one, Homer, is that, you know, many people who are religious say it's God's will when, you know, it's God's decision that when you should die. However, you can make the argument that, you know, if someone wants to commit suicide and they're religious, is that not God's influence on their life saying maybe it's time for you to end your life? We can go down this road, and I suspect we'll probably end up annoying ourselves and annoying the rest of the listeners going down that one reader. Well, you know, if you're religious and you commit suicide, but hang on, God's surely encouraged you to commit suicide. Hey, and if you want to post about this one, go ahead. I'm going to be happy on this one.
Yeah, I think I will too. Me personally, I don't see myself ever airing my own suicide. And let's face it, 90% of this sort of thing is for ratings anyway. But that being said, if a person is at the end of his life and is in pain, or even what you were talking about with the I think you said it was a rugby player that was paralyzed.
23-year-old. Yeah, they were looking to charge his parents and a friend for assisting him, because clearly that is an offence in the United Kingdom, and you know the Crown Prosecution Service have turned around and said a prosecution would not be in the interests, which basically means that yes, they probably could have prosecuted them, but they just don't think it's the right thing to do. You know, the family have suffered enough, the fact that their son, you know, had this tragic accident, and now they've had to, you know, live and work with their child to help him end his life, which, you know, I think the prosecution service are turning around and maybe and saying to these people, you've suffered enough, you know, punishing you by taking you to court and potentially imprisoning you, I don't think is actually going to do any good here.
Yeah, and thank you, common sense finally rears its head. I mean, these people have been through enough. This is not a decision that any parent is going to take lightly. It's not something that they just woke up and says, I think I'll help my son commit suicide. You know, their lives have been tragic, obviously, for a long period of time. And the last thing we need to do is step in and prosecute people for this.
Exactly. And you have to think this documentary, you know, is going to be, you know, for ratings. And no doubt, you know, it is such a controversial subject. It is a hot potato. It is things that, you know, people are, you know, you are typically fairly black and white on this one. You either accept that suicide is something that someone has the right to do, or you don't. Airing it, well, it's interesting what they're actually going to air. You know, are they actually going to air the moment of this gentleman expiring, or are they going to show, you know, almost in a documentary sense, you know, him making the decisions, talking through, planning, getting there, potentially getting to this clinic, having the discussions with the people at the clinic, and then being in the room, and then, you know, maybe taking something. Are they actually going to be filming him as he draws his last breath? And I think you can sort of say you could have a documentary that spoke about this gentleman's thought processes and what he went through to do that one. You could have a little segment of him being there, then you could close the door, then you could have potentially some kind of wrap-up with his family or with something else. It's a question of, are they actually going to show the moment he stops breathing and someone walks in there and says, yes, this man has passed away? I think that's... if it's that bit, I think a lot of people are going to be probably fairly... that's probably going to be really up there with, do we really want to see that on TV?
Well, apparently the guy that's producing this, his name is Zaritsky, told the BBC Radio 4 Hours Today program, quote, I think it would be less than honest if we were to do a film about the process of assisted suicide and not actually be able to see the ultimate, you know, act, as it were. So, there we have it.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I suspect from knowing a little bit about some other cases here that it's sort of not exactly a violent death in the sense you thrash around. I understand they give you a cocktail of things that basically, you know, you fall asleep. But one of the interesting things regarding sort of this whole suicide thing has always been that, now, if you had a pet and you kept your pet in the way that we keep some human beings once their sort of lives, their quality of life deteriorates, you would probably be prosecuted for cruelty to animals if you kept an animal alive like we keep some human beings alive.
Yeah, and this came to a head here in the United States several years ago. I'm sure you read about the young lady, I can't think of her name, that was on a feeding tube and arguably had no brain action whatsoever, and yet we were just keeping her alive for the sake of keeping her alive.
Exactly, and but you would not keep your dog, your cat, your horse, or whatever in that kind of condition. We seem more capable of making a decision about, you know, our pets, you know, and it depends whether you just think of them as animals or part of the family. You know, I take the view that the pets we have are part of our family. Therefore, I would never, you know, if I take professional advice from a veterinary surgeon in, you know, and he sort of says, you need to think about it, I'm going to think about it because I trust our veterinary practice. But, you know, I think many of us know when our animals are telling us something. The worst thing is we cannot do the same thing for our loved ones. We have to, you know, you have to wait for them to die naturally. You know, and that could be 15 years on a tube. And you just think, for me personally, Homer, I'm not sure I'd want to sit there being someone who may be suffering from a degenerative mental disease who, you know, I don't recognize, you know, my loved ones and families for, you know, days on end. You know, I got to be thinking, is that the way I want people to see me at the end of my life?
Yeah, exactly, Martin. I'm a do not resuscitate, and I don't care who knows that. You know, if I die, leave me alone. You know,
exactly.
Don't bring me back as a vegetable. Leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, then these other views that says, fine, and if you want to carve my body up, if I can help somebody save someone else, I'm dead. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I just love these people that have these religious convictions, too, against donating organs. What are you going to do with them?
Hang on a minute. If someone has that view, then I think they're absolutely entitled to have that view.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying they're not entitled to have the view. I think it's ridiculous.
Certainly, you know, people, you know, certainly, I know people who are Mormon, Jehovah's Witnesses, and, you know, a guy I knew, his father did pass away because they wouldn't have a blood transfusion. You know, fair play, I have to, you know, you sort of think, God, whoa, why? But then when you actually analyze it, you think, you know, the conviction and faith that this man had and his family had, you have to commend them for having something so strong in their lives that they're prepared to say, I believe this is the way that I want to live my life. And, you know, and I have a greater respect for this person. I disagree with fundamentally why someone just didn't go and say tough, but I respect him more because he lived his life according to a set of rules, and those set of rules said you cannot do this, and he was prepared to say my faith is that important to me that I will live my life based on these set of rules that have been given to me.
I agree, and again, I'm with you. I commend that sort of faith and that sort of conviction in a person's own moral and ethical values. They're not mine, but I do commend people that have them.
Yeah, they have. So what we might do is maybe have maybe get Homer to do a rather more light-hearted rant. This has been sort of a fairly dull, a fairly hard subject to end the show on. Not dull. I do apologise. It's not dull, but it's been a hard subject. You know, suicide is hardly the most jolly subject on the planet. So Homer will no doubt, we'll get him to do a more light-hearted rant this week.
Yes, I'm going to do a rant on Christmas, and I hope everybody enjoys it.
Ah, yes, and just before you go, there are numerous ways that you can get this show. I prefer to go down the taking it from iTunes route, but I think Homer likes to go around the RSS route.
I can never find my iPod, so yeah, I do the RSS route, and then it's on my computer, and I just come and listen to myself ramble.
Hey, great. Remember, you can always find links to how to download this show on the show thread. And as usual, if you have any comments, anything you want to say, you like the show, you don't like the show, you agree with what Homer and I have said, or you disagree with what Homer and I have said, you can either U2U us, you can email us, or you can post something in the show thread.
And sounds good to me, Martin.
Oh, yes. I have been Martin Bain.
And I am always Homer Fife.
And we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
Hello, everyone. This is Homer, and this is just the way I see it. Christmas. Bah, humbug. Christmas is supposed to be all about the children, right? Then why are we getting shot, shooting at, stabbed, stabbing, and trampled to death, all in the name of the great holiday of peace? As everyone knows, I'm a capitalist, and this is not about the corporations. If those same corporations can produce a product that causes all of you to go mad in some ill-conceived attempt to get your obviously spoiled little brats the latest and trendy toys, well, more power to them. You are the ones causing all the death and destruction. See, I remember Christmas when it was really Christmas. The best thing about it was when the whole family showed up and all of us kids would be running around, throwing snowballs, falling into creek, getting wet, and, well, just generally making a nuisance of ourselves. And what did we get under the tree? Socks, underwear, and if we were lucky, we got a toy or two, fruit, maybe some candy. And as I got older, tools and, well, things I needed. You remember, thoughtful gifts. While currently we are bombarded with study after study after study about the negative effects of television and video games on our children, we still can't wait to rush in a mad stampede to buy the ridiculously overpriced latest games being shoved down our Christmas Yuletide throats. Now, folks, are we really doing this for the children, or are we doing it for ourselves? There is a compulsion that is felt by every parent to give our children everything we did not have. But in doing this, how much harm are we also doing? Is it not true that the greatest gift we can give our children is the gift of love? And love can be difficult sometimes, especially when you have to say no. Some of my most favorite memories are sitting on a front porch swing with my granny, and we would look through the Montgomery Ward catalog, or, as Granny called it, the Monkey Ward catalog, and we would look at all of the things that we couldn't have, things that we just couldn't afford them. Now, would I still cherish that memory if Granny could have bought me everything I wanted? Nah, I'd say not. Now, growing up, I was a hunter. Relax, folks, I'm not anymore. But growing up, I was. We were very poor, and taking game supplemented our diets and saved us a lot of money. Now, the year my granny and my aunts and uncles all got together, pooled their money, and they bought me my first deer rifle. It was a Marlin 30-30 lever action, but it wasn't really a Marlin, believe it or not, folks. That's correct. It was a Montgomery Ward model. It was made by Marlin, but it was sold by Montgomery Ward years ago. Now, that still remains in my memory as the best Christmas ever. It is still, to this day, one of my most favorite Christmas presents I've ever received. Along with all the requisite socks and underwear, that was a fantastic Christmas. My family, we all got together every year at the big farmhouse where I was raised, and each Christmas Eve, while my granny and my aunts put this big ham in the oven, the men and me would all carry in wood for the stove and sit around and tell tall tales, and if it snowed, we'd go sled riding down Bald Knob, and then after it got dark, all the men would hide the bottle of booze in the spring house like we didn't know where it was, and we would all gather for a game or two of canasta. Well, until somebody lost and got mad, and, well, that's a whole other story. And all of us kids, of course, would be playing hide-and-seek or some other game and taking the numerous continued trips by the tree and looking at the gifts and wondering exactly what was in those many packages so brightly bound in wonderful Christmas paper and those colorful ribbons. And now, folks, that was Christmas. Not standing in line waiting for a store to open so that we can trample our neighbors to death, all for the sake of saving a dollar on the latest video games our children probably shouldn't have. Wake up, people. Let's get back to Christmas. This is Homer Fife, and that's just the way I see it.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.